This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm pleased to be interviewing Bill Ayers, author of Fugitive Days, a memoir of his time in the Weather Underground. Bill Ayers is a professor of education at the University of Illinois in Chicago and director of the Center for Youth in Society. Bill Ayers, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt. Good to be here.
Tell me, why did you write this book?
You know, it's I think there's a series of motives interconnected. I know that I never felt like I could tell this story until a certain amount of time passed and until I felt kind of capable of writing a bit. I'd written several books about education, and then I wrote a book about the juvenile detention center in Chicago called The Kind and Just Parent. And when I finished that, I said to myself, I think I've got enough distance from that decade, and I've got enough skill to take it on. But as I was working on it, I kept saying to myself, is there anything more egotistical than writing a memoir? And the more I thought about it, the more I was sure there wasn't anything more monumentally self-centered.
Well, you're not the only person writing memoirs these days.
No, I'll say. In fact, I took up the task of reading a ton of memoir as I was writing this one. And, you know, it's a, like everything else, it's hugely uneven. But I do think it the popularity of it has something to do with the fact that we do lead storied lives, and in some ways fact is stranger than fiction. And people have found this as a way to tell the story of our lives, the story of history, the story of America in certain periods of time.
And you have many disclaimers in there that this isn't the absolute truth, the last word on the 60s, the last word on that movement, because memoir is almost notoriously questionable at some levels.
Well, what I argue, actually, and I argue it again in the afterword to this paperback edition, is that I do it through a series of interludes, but what I argue is that the whole memoir enterprise is a lie. I mean, we remember in our favor 90% of the time, and that's true of individuals. It's fatally true of societies. I often think of the U.S. as the United States of amnesia. We forget our collective past, and I think we forget it at our peril.
Well, the government wants us to forget.
Well, exactly, and it gets papered over, and of course we want to think of ourselves as good people, so we want to forget the unseemly difficult parts of our history. The problem is that forgetting those parts of our history allows us to recreate and reproduce them again and again. But in terms of memoir, I'm saying again and again, I think that memory lies, and that you should take this with a grain of salt. I'm very clear that this is not a manifesto. It's a memoir. It answers the essential memoir question, which is, how did a guy like this get into a place like that?
Well, let's start right there. I mean, how did you get involved in the anti-war movement?
Well, I guess I was just lucky on one level. I came to Michigan from the kind of padded privilege of the 50s and in Chicago. I came to the University of Michigan where my eyes really opened, and I try to document in the book what it felt like to wake up from what was kind of a sleepwalking existence to a world in flames, and try to take that world seriously, try to understand it, try to understand and answer the basic question, who in the world am I, emphasizing in the world, and trying to kind of be a participant in the world, not simply an observer, not simply an object of history. And so I found myself at Michigan as the war in Vietnam escalated, 1965. And I went to my first meetings kind of reluctantly, but the more I understood, the more I got sucked into that movement, and the more it fit me and it suited me. And the more earnestly I took it, the more commitments I made.
And Bill Ayers, you then became a member of SDS.
That's right.
And became somewhat of a leader in Ann Arbor, would you say?
I was the leader of SDS in Ann Arbor in the mid-late 60s. I was first arrested opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965. By 1967, I was a leader of SDS in Ann Arbor, and then nationally a couple years later.
And you'd been arrested a couple dozen times, you
That's
say
right.
in this book.
That's right.
Was there a pivotal moment in the anti-war movement that made you move from nonviolent protest to something a little bit different?
I think the pivotal moment, there were probably a couple, but you know, one pivotal moment that I describe in the book is meeting the Vietnamese themselves, because then, like now, the enemy is always demonized. There must be a villain. In fact, recently I reread 1984, and I was shocked. I had forgotten certain things, like every morning at 10, everyone in 1984 has to go and turn on the television and participate in 2 minutes of hate. And there's a guy named Emmanuel Goldstein whose picture appears, and we spend 2 minutes hating him. And even George Orwell, who was prescient in many ways, couldn't have predicted Fox News and 24/7 minutes of hate. But in any case,
There seems to be a spot in the American psyche for hatred, or a drawer labeled hate.
Yeah, exactly.
And a template for
the
hate.
The thing that's so sad about where we're living now is that this is played like a fine-tuned violin. We hated Osama bin Laden. He morphed into Saddam Hussein. It's about to morph into the leader of Syria. But in those days, it was the Vietnamese who had horns. Ho Chi Minh was the devil. And when we met the Vietnamese in Canada initially, and later in Cuba and Eastern Europe, what was shocking to me was how profoundly human they were, how three-dimensional, how ordinary in a sense. And that was one very important moment for me, and a moment that stays with me. It was the first realization that every human life is equal to every other, and the demonization of other human beings is not only immoral, but is politically dangerous and treacherous. That was one. A second was certainly 1968. By 1968, I'd been an organizer for a long time. We had convinced the majority of the American people to oppose the war in Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not run for president. We felt that we had achieved a significant victory. When the war went on, and didn't just go on, but escalated, when we recognized that 2,000 innocent people would be killed a day, and every day we couldn't stop the war, another 2,000 would die. And situated in 1968 as opposed to 2003, we didn't know that when that war would end. It seemed to us the war of all wars, the endless war, the eternal war. And that was decisive too, because I was determined to do everything I could to end the war. And in the late 1960s, 1969, and then 1970, I, along with a group of others, decided that we had to build both the capacity to survive what we saw as a coming American Gestapo, and we had to be able to take the fight to the enemy. We had to do material damage to the ability of the Americans to fight the war.
So this is what was called propaganda of the deed.
Yeah, and that's what it was called in Latin America, and we borrowed that understanding, sure.
And so the weathermen or the weather underground, as a member of that group, you would participate in bombings.
Right. That's one of the things we did, is that we organized ourselves to carry out what we called armed propaganda, or propaganda of the deed. And it was an attempt to both cripple materially the ability of the American government to fight the war, and symbolically to demonstrate to people both the vulnerability and also the wrongness of this war.
But let's look at both of those, because the capacity to cripple the Pentagon, you didn't really have that capacity.
You're not kidding. You know, the dream was big, and it was grandiose, and there was a kind of a mixture of grandiose dreaming and deep despair. But what we imagined ourselves doing was learning how to do damage to, for example, military planes that were bound for Vietnam. And in the course of that, recruiting others, learning how to go from small to large, and learning how to fight. And in our minds, yes, to go on from ending the war in Vietnam to creating a revolution in the United States. And, of course, it didn't work out that
way. And that
way.
Gets to that second point you had. You know, how do you persuade people? Or what is the best way of convincing people that the war is immoral? And I'm struck by you bringing up the meeting you had with the Vietnamese, because you write in your book that the Vietnamese whom you met were much more animated about how you plan to reach your Republican parents than your willingness to die for the cause.
Absolutely, and that's one of the ironies. I mean, the book and the story is filled with ironies, but that's one, that here we had these grandiose dreams of making the revolution, and when we met our revolutionary heroes, they said, in effect, they're there. Go talk to your parents.
And they had wisdom about that.
A lot of wisdom. And the fact is that I look back on that, and I think this is captured in the tone and the content of the book. I look back on that and I say, you know, we were grandiose and we were despairing. And the important thing that I draw from that time is that the major occupation of a radical, of a revolutionary, of a progressive is pedagogical, is educational. And so whether you're going door to door and knocking on doors, whether you're writing articles and leaflets, whether you're sitting in at a draft board or at a government office or having a die-in on the street, or whether you're escalating in a certain context to a more militant or even an illegal or even an armed resistance, the goal is always education, because the only thing that changes society is people mobilized who want to change society.
But the means to achieving that goal, leaving aside for the second whether they are moral in some fundamental ways, weren't really doing that. I mean, those bombings, that kind of activity.
I'm not so sure. I judge it perhaps a little differently. I'm not so sure. In fact, my whole life, I mean, I had a difficult time making distinctions in those years, partly because everything I ever did in opposition to the war in Vietnam, there was a chorus standing near me saying, that's ineffective. So when I picketed and demonstrated, people told me that was ineffective. And then when I sat in at the draft board, I was told that was ineffective. When I fought in the streets of Chicago, that was ineffective. And when I participated in building an organization that put a bomb in the Pentagon, I was told that was ineffective. In fact, given the context of that escalation, given the context of the war, given the bloodiness and the deadliness of that war, I actually think all of those things were effective. They were part and parcel of a movement. I actually don't think anyone in America said, I'm anti-war now, but I looked at that Pentagon bombing and damn it, now I'm pro-war. I don't think I can find a single individual who went that way.
I have another counterexample actually to that. I'm talking with Bill Ayers, author of Fugitive Days, here in Madison, Wisconsin, where I've been living the last 20 years. When the Army Math Resource Center was bombed, it really took all the air out of the anti-war movement.
Yeah, and I think that's a much different example than what I was thinking of, but you're absolutely right. And one of the things that makes that different is a distinction that's not trivial, and that is the distinction between destroying life and destroying military hardware or property. When the Barragans bang on the nuclear warheads, I don't think that turns people off. But if they were to kill a technocrat or a researcher or somebody who was taking care of those nuclear warheads, I think that would be a much more serious
And the bombers
question.
Here didn't mean to kill anyone. The bomb went
they
off early in the
to.
Morning, but they didn't. But they did.
They didn't
and
mean to,
the
but they did.
The but your bomb in the Pentagon could have killed someone.
It could have, and that's worth noting and important to note. But it's also important to note that we, as an organization, in our despair, in our determination, we did flirt with the idea of terrorism. And I take terrorism to be the indiscriminate killing of innocents for some supposed higher purpose. We never went down that road. We killed three of our own, and I try to document that as fairly and honestly as I can. And then we said no. Terrorism is out for us. We will not go that way.
You killed three in an accident.
In an accident. Yeah. We killed three of our own people in an accident, right. And then we pulled back from what I considered the abyss, and we said, no, this is propaganda of the deed. This is material damage to the war effort, and we are going to not only take every precaution, but we're going to get into a dialogue with the FBI and we're going to be taken seriously. And we were. And it is something of a miracle, but it's also something of a determined choice that we never killed anyone.
But you did make an attempt to kill some racist police officers in Cleveland.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We flirted with terrorism, and we didn't do it, which is amazing. But we made an attempt, and that was...
You planted a bomb in the police department. It didn't go off for some mechanical
reason.
Exactly.
And so, again, I try to document what it's like to be in a place where terrorism has a logic to you. And then I try to also document what it's like to pull back from that. I don't defend what we did.
But you do seem really ambivalent about it now and also in the book.
I'm not ambivalent about killing people.
No, ambivalent about the tactic of...
I'm not ambivalent about it. I think it was justified. I think the Berrigan's actions were justified. I think killing people and killing innocent people is never justified. There is no justification. And I think that in the struggle that we were involved in the anti-war movement, killing people, even people who were preparing to go to Vietnam and so on, would have been beyond the pale. And it's something we didn't do, and I feel both quite fortunate.
You were lucky, though, because the tactics...
That's exactly
the
right.
The tactics implicated the possibility of killing someone.
Well, you mean the tactic of bombing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose, except as I say, there's two things going on. One is a real attempt to be safe, and the other is... A kind of an agreement with the FBI that when we said what we were going to do, they knew we meant it, and they cleared the area. So that was, again, a quirk of history, but it did happen.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Bill Ayers, author of Fugitive Days, and now a professor of education at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Let me ask you a question, though, to put it back and to get the conversation about violence mm-hmm. and other... Is there ever a time when violence is justified? And is the distinction between violent tactics against property and violence tactics against people a worthwhile one?
Well, I think those are real tough questions for me, Bill.
Me too. They're tough for me.
Yeah. I mean, I do think what the Berrigans do, what my friend Sam Day used to do,
right.
what Bonnie Erford did when she chopped down a tower at the Elf
right.
nuclear transmitter up north, was... certainly understandable, and I don't really find something terrible about that. Though
right.
I am really kind of opposed to vigilantism, even when
right.
it doesn't hurt an individual. And I'm more, and I wrestle with this very often. I'm more aligned with the Gandhian, you know, be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah, I am too. In fact, and the other thing, I am too, and I respect that. But the thing that I think is difficult about first of all, I think we shouldn't be ambivalent at all about what's called for today. Today, what's called for is the mobilization of people in legal, well, not necessarily legal, but certainly in open public opposition to government policies. I don't see the conditions now favoring the notion of creating a kind of a clandestine or illegal apparatus. But I do think, so I want to be clear about that. But I also think that theoretically it's very hard for me to give up the idea that there are times come, crises come, where you have to hold out the possibility of an armed resistance, or you've granted a monopoly of violence to the state, and that's a mistake.
I mean, for me, the hard questions really are, you know, the Warsaw Ghetto. Should the Jews have fought
exactly.
back in the Warsaw
exactly.
Ghetto? Or a less clear-cut case, you know, Nelson Mandela and the ANC, should they have taken up arms or not? You know, liberation struggles.
And they did.
And, you know, I'm anxious. Nelson Mandela is one of the people I'm just dying to interview, and I got to do it in a hurry. Because I want to ask him this, because I am not certain even there whether taking up arms was the pivotal thing that brought liberation
sure
in
pivotal,
South Africa,
or
whether it was, you know, the mass strikes in the 80s.
Well, I think Nelson Mandela would say, and I've heard him talk about this, but I think he would say that even when we took up arms, it was under political leadership. It wasn't arms for arms' sake, and they distanced themselves from the terrorism that was carried out by some of their cadres and some of the people in the street. But I think Mandela's an important example. I think Gandhi's important. I think the Warsaw Ghetto is important. You probably know, you've probably read Orwell's piece about Gandhi. But Gandhi, just to take an extremist At his word, Gandhi said that what the Jews of Europe should have done was commit mass suicide rather than take up arms.
Martin Luther King is worth talking about because he said we should endure their capacity to inflict suffering, and by enduring it, convince the rest of the world that this can't go on anymore, and convince some of the people who are doing the imposing of suffering.
Of course, he made that argument in what could be argued was a liberal capitalist democracy where there was some limit. Gandhi made his argument, again, against someone around whom there was some limit. But I'm not sure that the Jews of Europe could have appealed to anybody to stop being run over.
That is the very hardest question
exactly,
for a pacifist.
For a pacifist, absolutely.
And I don't call myself a fundamental pacifist because I can't wrestle that Hitler problem to the ground from a pacifist position.
Or take slavery, to take another example from our own country. Should the slaves have taken up arms against their oppressors? Should John Brown have invaded Harper's Ferry? Or even more to the point, should the North have invaded the South, which they did? I think that what Sherman did marching to the sea was surely an act of terrorism and therefore indefensible. But I don't think it was indefensible for the North to march into the South. Slavery had to end.
Mm-hmm. That's another hard one. And John Brown, though, is a trickier character because he killed people who were on a grand jury, as you mentioned in here.
Absolutely, and that was an act of terror. And
he was a vigilante terrorist who was similar to some extent to what I would call you and your colleagues back in those days.
I'm so flattered by the comparison that I can hardly breathe. But at the same time, I think with Brown, you can also make distinctions. What he did in Kansas with the grand jury was probably indefensible. What he did at Harper's Ferry was a bit more defensible. And in any case, I think he did start the Civil War. And in a sense, it's a good thing.
I'm speaking with Bill Ayers, author of Fugitive Days. At the end and in your afterword, you try to rebut some of the critics who read the book and criticized you for not being apologetic or coming to terms in a way that they wanted you to with the tactics that you employed. And you write defiantly, "I regret nothing, and we probably didn't do enough." What should have you done?
Well, you know, we should have been smarter for sure. We should have been better. We should have held to the unity that SDS represented, even as it was being torn apart by sectarian battles. I can look back and think actually of 1,000 regrets. What I don't regret is the kind of extreme things that people like to point to, like the bombing of the Pentagon. That's what I don't regret. But you can't live to be 58 years old and not have 1,000 regrets, and so I have many. I also argue, incidentally, I wrote 187-page afterword. Penguin decided to print 10 of those pages, so I have a lot more to think about. But I also think that going back to where you began, the question of memoir, I think we need a lot more memoirs. I think many, many stories need to be told for us to understand that period. I don't claim that this is a definitive story. It's one man's story.
And where are we today? I see you have a button on no war.
Yeah, don't give up your buttons because they're going to become more relevant as each year passes. Where are we today? I feel, and I'd be interested in your response to this. I think we're in the deepest crisis I've ever seen. The anti-war movement during the Vietnam years was the biggest anti-war movement in history internationally. It was surpassed in the last few months. I'm so hopeful that this deep and frightening crisis that we're entering is also the deepest opportunity we've ever had to transform our society, to throw the bums out in Washington, to get rid of the right-wing junta that's got all three branches of government, and to create a society based on basic principles of law and justice, and find ourselves as a country among countries in the world, not the supreme country, not the empire, but a nation among nations. It is within our reach.
And Bill Ayers, you said earlier that this is a different situation. The conditions are different than they were back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, so you don't counsel people to take up arms in this propaganda, the deed, as you did before. Why and how are the conditions different that would not be a proper course from where you stand?
Well, the major difference, I think, is that we do not have at this point a left in this country. What we have is a vague collection of sentiments and people who read the Progressive magazine, who read The Nation, but we don't have leadership, finances, a strategy, tactics. All those things are weapons that the right does have. So there really is an organized right wing in this country that's very powerful and happens to be in power at this point. But our task, it seems to me, is to take the discontent, the passivity, the cynicism, the anger that exists, and really use this moment to educate, educate, educate. Every time we see the right wing pass a bill that supports our troops or salutes the flag and then turns around and cuts benefits to veterans or cuts health care or cuts opportunities for kids to go to school, we should use that as a pedagogical mm-hmm. opportunity. And we should try very hard, and maybe the Progressive is one of those institutions that can help us do this. We should try to build a commonality, a strategy, a tactics, a leadership, and what we might call really a forceful left with a realistic, realizable goal.
And what is that realistic, realizable goal?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that comes from building the movement. But I think, certainly, we have to build a movement that gestures towards a kind of socialism, a kind of sharing of the wealth, a kind of calming down of the adventuristic kind of monopolistic drive of corporate power. We have to find a way globally to be a citizen, a nation that is a citizen, that appreciates and honors international law. We have to stand for international law. We have to play by the same rules that we ask everybody else to play by. And it seems to me that if we don't find a way to articulate that goal, and I'm not doing a very good job, that the fate of the earth is in the balance. I think capitalism unchecked is a recipe for disaster.
That will have to be the last word. Bill Ayers, thanks for being my guest on Progressive Radio.
Matt, thanks very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.